A Job for a Death Worlder, Chapter 2, written by Lanzan Yars, read by Daniel Million. More themselves made a sound that seemed distressed and heavily combed through the hair on their neck with their claws.
"I completely forgot,"
they said in a tone that made James guess a human would have had their face in their hands by now. James lifted an eyebrow at them, and looked back at the door when the voice calling out sounded crisp and near, even to him. It was a high-pitched voice, high-pitched and quiet.
"Yes, I am here, Queese,"
Moore shouted back towards the corridor. No one had yet appeared into view, but the shout stopped for a moment. Then someone appeared in the door. James had to admit, it looked a little ridiculous, seeing the tiny person standing in the ginormous doorway. He estimated that they didn't even reach up to his thigh. For Moore, they were barely as tall as their ankle. Other than Moore, they appeared to hail from a world where evolution had taken a very different path from Earth. The best way he could describe them to another human, and quite frankly himself, was a mixture of an amphibian and some kind of land shark. Their appearance was honestly quite repulsive to his eyes. They had 6 limbs total. 2 long and 2 short legs were used for elevation and locomotion, their multiple joints sticking out at concerning angles. The last 2 limbs were even shorter and seemingly their equivalent of arms, even though James was not sure how well they could manipulate tools, considering their short length and the apparent stiffness of their 3 symmetrically distributed fingers. Their unproportionately big head stood a little way up from their arms with almost no neck. It was elongated and flat, with their 3 cold, dead fish eyes placed unblinking on top of its flat surface. Their maw was big, and allowed no assumptions considering their diet. A round, thick tail at their backside served as counterbalance to their massive head. And while all that may have not been appealing, what really did freak James out was their skin. Or, more specifically, what was on their skin. They were over and over covered in teeth. More specifically, teeth-like scales, like sharks had them on Earth, only looking way more like incisors than James was comfortable with. Their ivory body glistened softly in the white light of the laboratory, making him shiver. Of course, he did not want to be rude, and he also knew that they were not at fault for him disliking their natural appearance, but overcoming a basic concept of your own mind could be very difficult. The newcomer looked up at Moore. "There you are," they signed, apparently more comfortable with nonverbal communication. James was not even sure how they formed the M in Moore without lips to begin with. "Yes, I am sorry," Moore signed back, causing James to step back so they could fully extend their arms without hitting him. "I got distracted on my way." The newcomer shook their body, giving James goosebumps with the grinding sound of their natural armor. He guessed it was their version of shaking their head. "Were you two arranged to meet?" James asked Moore, shaking off the tingles in his neck. He also did not bother to join in on the signing, seeing as the participants clearly were able to hear.
"Indeed,"
Moore answered, this time also verbally.
"We were arranged to meet at the casino for our meal today."
The newcomer, apparently named Keese, shifted their gaze over to James. He could read absolutely nothing in those dead eyes, but he could have sworn that they started to move less while looking at him.
"I was actually on my way when I ran into you, and we had our little misunderstanding,"
Moore continued. The newcomer perked up. "Misunderstanding?" they signed. So Moore and James took some time to explain the incident. In the meantime, James felt a feeling coming up in his stomach. The mention of food had apparently reminded his subconsciousness that he had not yet eaten today.
"James?"
Moore addressed him all of a sudden, ripping him out of his train of thought.
"Excuse me, my mind must have wandered off," he said awkwardly, rubbing his temples.
He looked at Moore to see what they wanted, but they just pointed over to the other crew member. Keese had apparently been signing at him while he was not paying attention.
"Keese just suggested that you humans, in spite of your lack of hair, might be a primate species,"
Moore explained from beside him.
"Is that the case?"
"That is correct," James said, still a bit embarrassed and spaced out on them. He glanced over at Moore, who seemed to somehow be a bit doubtful of his claim. But after a moment, they apparently shook off their thought.
"In that case, would you perhaps like to join us for our meal? That way we could continue our talk a bit longer,"
they suggested, putting on what he guessed was their version of a smile. In that case? What did they mean by that? He decided to not read too much into what might have just been a grammatical error while translating both of their native languages to the uniform language. Also, his grumbling stomach urged him to go eat something anyway, so he might as well join them. Being in the company of his seniors would make it easier to get initiated into some circles among the crew members, he figured. So, he agreed, and together they made their way through the corridors. He was astounded to find that due to their small size, Kreese didn't use the normal corridor, but instead a sort of recess in the wall he had wondered about before. It was situated slightly higher than his full height on both walls, and there were ladder-like structures leading up to it every few meters, as well as next to every door and at every junction. He explained a bit about his ideas considering his work, explaining some general concepts of the methods usually employed in human laboratories. His colleagues were mostly interested in how he would hope to cross the species barrier. He sort of dodged the question, not entirely sure how to explain that the hardest part about that would be not having the medicine kill off the patient faster than the pathogens they were supposed to cure could. Good for him was that the two-factor immune system that most Earth creatures possessed was so literally alien to them that their questions remained on a pretty shallow level. On their way, he tried to divide his attention between the conversation and memorizing the way to the casino. They walked past a lot of different laboratories, some closed up tight, some open, with different people of different species waving out at them. After a while, they left the part of the spaceship designated to the research team and entered the common area, where everyone needed to keep the ship running while they did their work was going about their day. With the change of occupation, the identifiers changed as well. While the white base remained, the black accents of the scientists were swapped for different colorations according to the different occupations. Ranking crew members were yellow, technicians were blue, security were green, medicals were pure white, and lastly, red signified contractors doing all kinds of work. James had been glad when he found out that the deaths among the contractors were, in fact, not any higher than among any other group on board. This part of the ship was busier than the science wing, having many different people scurrying about, going about their day. James now also understood why Kweese and other smaller occupants of the ship used the recesses to get around. He had problems with getting out of the way of everyone's legs or arms. Even though he was a good bit taller than Kweese, and even tall for a human, among the ship's inhabitants, he was dwarfed by most other people. Not to say that it would have been a problem if they did hit him. They would most likely trip over while only mildly inconveniencing him. Still, he had no desire of testing this theory. So he ducked, dodged, and weaved his way through the people crowding the deck. Good thing he was light on his feet. Quite literally. Yet, all of a sudden, the seemingly endless assault of limbs at the height of his head stopped. Irritated, he looked through the corridor and he realized that he was alone. Well, kind of. Looking over his shoulder, he realized everyone else had stopped on some sort of imaginary border, crowding and forming a wall of people behind him. Even Moore and Kweese had stopped still, seemingly stressed. He then looked in front of him, again seeing the same phenomenon take place only a few meters in front. And in between those two walls of people he stood, having apparently wandered into no man's land, completely oblivious to whatever danger kept everyone else rooted in place. The only thing differentiating this hallway from any other hallway they had crossed today was its floor. Instead of the typical gray tile, it was a thick, full-length window, allowing a view into the void of space and the endless celestial bodies shining within it. He gazed out of it for a few moments, marveling at the view, his semi-translucent reflection looking back up at him. Then, returning to reality, he looked at the empty patch of corridor. Well, almost empty. In fact, contrary to his first assumption, he was not alone, and his eyes widened. There before him, slumped against the wall and apparently either dozing off or unconscious, lay a woman. No, it couldn't be. Two arms, two legs, obviously designed to walk upright, seemingly hairless except for the head and, more importantly, clad in a neat white uniform with yellow accents. The similarities were staggering. Looking a bit closer, however, it became clear that it was, in fact, not a woman, at least not a human one. The features of her face were too sharp. The nose did not protrude from the face enough, was colored darker than the rest of her brown skin, and was also formed slightly differently, with narrower nostrils than any human could have. The line of her frizzy dark brown hair ended low, almost halfway down the back of her nape. On her neck, just above her uniform, he could see that below her face, dark lines started to appear on her dark reddish skin. The palms of her hands were shorter, and her fingers, in comparison, longer. Also, her palm and fingertips were coated with dark pads. Those, however, were not what clued him into her not being human. No, that honor went to her ears, which were big, pointy, open, and located further up on the side of her head than in a human's, as well as covered in hair on the outside, and her tail covered in short striped fur, differing from her hair on her head, respectively. Could she possibly be the reason nobody went into this hallway? James doubted it, but could not just yet rule it out. Of course, he could have just asked anyone why they had stopped, if only that had occurred to him at the moment. But he was worried about the person just laying in the open corridor. Would someone really just fall asleep here? Were people worried she was sick? Was that why they had stopped? His human instincts taking over at the sight of what looked so much like a member of his own species, he purposefully walked towards her. Her ears twitched slightly as he neared her, so at least she was definitely not dead. Then, automatically, his first aid training from back on Earth sprung into effect, causing him to kneel down next to her and going through the steps in his mind. First, try to get a response. "Excuse me, are you all right?" he said loudly. The ears twitched again and the woman seemed to scowl a bit. At least it would have been a scowl on a human, but she did not respond. If a person is unresponsive, try shouting out to them. He raised his voice a bit. "Excuse me!" he shouted. The face of the woman darkened even more, but once again she did not answer or acknowledge him. From behind him, a soft voice called out to him, unusually quiet if not careful. He ignored it. If the person is still unresponsive, try tapping their shoulder if the person is an adult or teenager, or the sole of the foot if the person is a child. Clearing his throat, he slowly reached out to her, once again saying, "Are you okay?" Again, someone called out to him in a shocked gasp, and the moment his hand even slightly grazed the woman's shoulder, her eyes suddenly burst open, and she shot upright from the wall. Her face crunched up into a snarl, showing her long, pointy teeth. The pin needle pupils of her yellow eyes darted around for a moment, and she bellowed out, "Can't you take a—" but stopped short when her eyes finally locked onto his face, her pupils narrowing down even more. But before James could even comprehend what just happened, the woman let out a loud hiss and shot around, pushing herself to her feet, during which she, in a fluent motion, struck at him with her right hand while spinning counterclockwise. James could just about lift his arm to shield his face, immediately hearing the sound of tearing fabric and feeling a piercing pain in his forearm. He grunted out in pain and fell back a few steps, clutching his arm and pressing it to his body. The woman by now stood, slightly cowering, before him. Both hands were held in a battle-ready position. The right one was covered in blood. Her legs were bent, ready to pounce at a moment's notice. And for a moment, their eyes locked, her burning gaze meeting his.
"James!"
a shocked voice yelled out from behind him, this time loud and clear, causing him to tear himself loose from the woman's eyes. Moore had called out to him.
"Sheeta!
Sheeta!"
A cacophony of appalled voices yelled out from both sides of the corridor, followed by a chorus of different accusations and some insults. James turned around to Moore, trying to calm them down with his non-injured hand, before turning back to the woman, who was apparently called Sheeta. But just like him, she had lost her focus. Her tense posture had relaxed and slumped down a bit. Her arms, ears, and tail also slowly began to sink down. Her eyes wandered along the crowd yelling at her, and all the aggression had disappeared from her face. Then, seemingly by coincidence, her eyes fell on him, now clutching his arm again. He wanted to lift his hand to reassure her, but the second he let go of his arm and his wound became visible to her eyes widened in shock, and without a word, she took off in the direction opposite of him, seemingly effortlessly shoving aside crew members twice her size, trying to stop her, before disappearing behind the wall of people. James was actually about to follow her, but to his surprise, Moore had loosened himself from the crowd behind him and stepped into the empty space between the walls of people, putting their massive hands on his shoulders.
"Are you all right?" they asked, worried.
James lifted his injured arm and carefully pulled aside the ripped sleeve in order to inspect the damage done. 5 deep, clean cuts ran along the top of his forearm from left to right, bleeding profusely, but it seemed like no important veins or arteries were harmed. It burned more than it hurt, and he could feel each beat of his heart echoing through the entire arm.
"Just a scratch," he answered, snickering.
"Was that a joke?"
Moore asked, seemingly in disbelief. Around them, James could hear the crowd talking agitatedly, seemingly organizing a response to what had just transpired. He turned around to Moore and looked up to their big, wet eye. Were they crying? Could they cry? The giant's gaze shifted between the floor and him, and he could not decide of which they appeared more worried. This time he answered with a more sincere, calm voice. "Really, it's fine. It's just a flesh wound."
"Just a flesh wound? What is that supposed to mean?"
Moore yelled out at him, swinging their branch-like arms around. James had forgotten that not everyone was as hardy nor as morbid as humans. "It just means that it looks worse than it is," he quickly explained. "The wound will heal just fine."
"But it is so... are you sure?"
they asked, calming down a bit and lowering their head towards him, nervously glimpsing out the window underneath them every so often. He lifted his hand and gave an okay sign.
"If you say so,"
Moore said, breathing deeply. Then, lifting their head and getting agitated again,
"Damn that beast! She really is a danger to us all!"
"Do you know her?" James piped up. Moore released air through their nose.
"Of course I do. Who doesn't?"
they blurted out, beginning to scratch random parts of their fur in agitation. James lifted one eyebrow and tilted his head. "Care to enlighten me?" he asked. Moore ceased her movements and looked down at James, once again seeming shocked.
"Have you not been warned about her?"
they asked, agitated.
"I thought everyone boarding is supposed to get informed in order to avoid panic."
"Panic?" James wondered aloud, unbelievingly thinking back to the woman, who had been slightly smaller than even him. Moore seemed to be getting uncomfortable talking about the topic, so they leaned all the way down to him and talked as quietly as her voice would allow.
"She is a miat,"
her voice softly booming directly next to his ear.
"A predator from a death world."
Moore seemed to be waiting for a reaction, but James was only confused what that had to do with anything. But before he could further inquire, the murmuring of the crowd behind him got louder, and as James glanced back, they parted to make way for a group of medics, most of them seemingly as hesitant as everyone else to enter the empty corridor, except for one of them, charging forward towards him before the rest of their team overcame themselves to join them. Moore's eyes widened as they got out of the way of the first medic. They were quite a bit taller than James, but not as big as other crew members, and were clad in white, sleek feathers, their steel-blue eyes staring into his own, while they looked over their sharp-looking beak, clearly once evolved to hunt and cut meat. They began peppering him with questions while their four wing-like arms started inspecting him with various medical instruments. The rest of the medical team had prepared a stretcher to carry him to the medical wing, which he graciously declined, instead opting to walk there himself, guided by the bird-like medic, in spite of the protests of most medics, feeling like his injuries were too grave to walk himself. He quickly turned to Moore while letting himself be pushed along and yelled, "You go on ahead and keep me a place! I'll join you as soon as I'm patched up!" As he was hurried along and reached the other end of the crowd, being able to walk straight once again, he noticed someone waiting for them. Leaned against the wall with a yellow identifier around his neck, showing many decorations of war and other awards, stood the captain of their vessel, Captain Faramore Utan. Captain Utan was a big man, and just like humans, he was a primate, but looked more like a monkey than an ape. His black eyes looked out of his dark face at James as he neared him. He pushed himself off the wall and walked up to him and his escort. They raised their hand in their respective versions of salute, and Utan responded in kind. His lips, that were tightly draped over his large teeth protruding a bit from his long jaw, were curled into what James knew was a smirk for his people. The short, sand-colored fur covering his body lay flat and showed complete relaxation.
"Missing medical already?"
the big man jabbed at him, his tail locked in continuous movement. James grinned back at him, completely exposing his teeth, this time on purpose. "Well, I do have a reputation of an entire species to uphold," he replied. A few minutes later, his arm was being stitched up by the four-armed medic while he finished making his report of the incident to the captain.
"Well, she sure got you good,"
Utan finally commented after looking at the wounds on his arm. "It's nothing," James answered and shrugged, his cool facade being only slightly inhibited by him every now and again flinching in pain when the needle entered his skin. "Are you sure you don't want any anesthetic?" asked the medic from his side. Her voice was high and melodical. He had by now found out that it was, in fact, a her. "I took the cut, I can also take the stitch," he answered, smiling, and then immediately winced as the needle once again pierced his hide. She rolled her blue eyes, but did not object.
"Back to the matter at hand," the captain chimed in. "What do we do now?"
"You're the captain. What do you mean, what do we do?" James asked, looking at the giant primate confusedly.
"Well, do you want to press charges?" Utan asked, his voice getting more serious.
The room got quiet as the medic just finished the last seam. James leaned back and supported himself with his arms.
"No, that won't be necessary," he answered casually. "It was my fault, really. I must have startled the poor girl."
Utan's mouth fell open a bit.
"Startled her?"
he asked, apparently caught completely unawares.
"Yes, I saw it in her eyes," James replied.
"Even if that is the case," the medic joined the conversation once more, "she ripped a hole in your arm."
"Well, she did have good reason to be scared," James said, leaning forward onto his knees now. "After all, she had not been informed about the Death World Predator on board, like everyone on board is supposed to be, in order to avoid a panic and a situation just like this one. Isn't that right?"
He made eye contact with the captain.
"You aren't seriously mad that I did not tell you, are you?"
Utan asked, surprised. James shook his head. "Of course not," he answered, annoyed. "But apparently everyone knows about her, but not me." Utan looked a bit taken aback. The medic let out a small chirping sound and angled her head sideways.
"That is different," the captain said quietly. "You are a primate. People don't expect you to be a predator, even if you look like one."
"A primate and a predator?"
the medic chirped, pretty much proving Utan's point. "A level 4 death world will do that to you," James answered, shrugging once more. Then he stood up, looking at Utan.
"It's fine, I get it," he stated, making his way back into the corridors.
"Just leave the girl alone. Seems she has enough problems already."
"Are you honestly not mad at all that she attacked you?"
the medic asked as he was leaving. James laughed a bit.
"She didn't attack me," he answered.
"That's just how cats are."
As he entered the casino specifically labeled as Herbivores, which he technically did not belong to, but he was going to ignore that for now, he realized how naive he had been to think that the hallways had been crowded. The room was ginormous, yet the people that were filling nearly every square meter of its gray floor still gave him a feeling of claustrophobia. The food was presented as a buffet, over many, many countertops, hundreds of different kinds of plants in all their forms, too many for him to even consider every kind, laid sprawled out. In front of the counters, there were metal contraptions made to be able to rest your tray instead of carrying it the whole time. In front of every counter were small, polished metal stairs so that even the smallest of crew members could reach atop each of the ivory-colored countertops in order to get their meal. Some of the counters looked more like a flower shop than something to eat, with all kinds of colorful leaves being propped up in different containers. Others were cornucopias of fruits as big as James' head. Of course, there were also prepared foods made from some different ingredients, being eagerly handed out by kitchen staff, distinguished by their red identifiers. A lot of eyes turned to him, probably because of his now one-sleeve uniform revealing the freshly stitched-up wounds. That, and the bloodstain still on the rest of his uniform. And his hairless skin. And his forward-facing predator eyes. Actually, there most likely were a lot of reasons. He scanned the room. Ironically, the giant form of Moor blended in with the rest of the giants so well that it was easier for him to find the small Quis, and he only did it because they started waving him over. Walking up to the two of them, he informed them that he would grab something to eat first before sitting down. In order to take the food back to the tables, there were two kinds of opaque trays to choose from. Big ones, about the size of the back seat of a typical car seat, and small ones, the size of an A4 sheet of paper. James decided to take one of the big ones, which wasn't especially heavy, but very unwieldy due to its size. Carefully, he maneuvered himself around the line of people waiting their turn in order to take his place at the end. The line moved much faster than he was used to from back on Earth. and quickly he had filled big parts of his tray with all kinds of different fruits, grains, and vegetables. Earth food was not yet available on board due to medical being concerned that people could ignore all warnings and consume Death World food without proper knowledge or precautions, accidentally killing themselves in the process. Just like the countertops, the tables were made to accommodate a lot of different kinds of people. On top of the tables were outward dents of varying size. Big people could easily just sit at the table and set their trays on top of those dents, while smaller people could climb on top of the table and use these dents as table substitutes while sitting on the tabletop. On Earth, this would probably be considered unhygienic, or at least pretty rude, but the food was not supposed to touch the table anyway. If you just left it on the trays, you would be fine. Chairs were apparently deemed too impractical to accommodate so many different forms and sizes, so they were scrapped completely. Everyone just sat either on the ground or on the tabletops. As James now neared the plain metallic table where Moore and Queese were already eating, he pondered whether he should climb on top of the table or just eat standing up, because he stood at a very awkward height between the almost big but also still small. He decided on the latter and lifted his tray, filled with leaves that reminded him of giant spinach, some cooked, small corned grain the color of old book pages, a green round fruit with wrinkly exterior and smelling mildly of maple, and a sort of stew, of the ingredients of which he had no idea about. But it did smell good, so he decided it was probably good enough. Up onto a place next to Moore, where the tabletop was even. As he greeted everyone, Moore was eating what looked like steamed grass to him. Queese, on the other hand, was eating something that looked like eggs? Pearls, maybe? Or maybe some nut using calcium or lime as a shell like animals did. He did not know. Queese had not gotten any less unsettling while he was in medical, and James decided to try to not look at them too much while eating. "You are back already," signed Queese at him from across the table once he had found a favorable position to stand at. James was not sure if it was a question or a statement, because their face was still completely unmoving. Moore was sitting next to him, still being bigger than him while sitting down. James lifted his arm above the table, showing them the handiwork of the medic up close. "I told you, I was just getting patched up," he added before starting to shovel some of the grain into his mouth. By now, he was very hungry. Moore seemed to take a moment to actually swallow their food before addressing James. "They literally sewed it shut," they said, like someone expecting a punchline. "It's how we do it back on Earth," James answered as soon as he was able, and wanted to keep his mouth empty for long enough. "Helps the body repair itself if the wound stays closed." "Your body repairs such grievous wounds on its own?" Queese signed while loudly cracking one of the pearl-like things in their massive jaws. "This? Grievous?" James laughed while pointing at the wound. "Losing an arm would be grievous. This is nothing."
"An adaptive immune system and a body that repairs itself on short notice," Moore summarized. "Humans appear to be quite hardy."
And once again, James answered, "Living on a death world will do that to you." The area around them fell quiet for a moment. Queese and Moore froze in their movements, leaving food slightly before their open mouths. Slowly putting the bite she had wanted to take back down onto their tray, Moore turned to see James better.
"You hail from a death world?"
they asked carefully. James nodded with a full mouth. Then he swallowed heavily and answered, "Yes, and a real bad one too, or so I've heard. Class 4.
"Class 4?
Moore parroted, and seemed to want to add something, but apparently she had no words at the moment. James lifted his hand and listed the classifications of Earth, lifting one finger for each point he made. "Extreme and unstable environmental conditions. Super heavy gravity. Inhospitable climate." He paused dramatically before lifting his fourth finger and ending with, "And hyper-competitive evolution." Once again, a lot of people had turned towards him. After finishing his bowl of grain, he munched down on a few of the big, soft leaves before adding, "Look, don't be sorry. It really isn't that bad. We were made for it, after all."
"That does explain how you could just shrug off an attack of a Miat,"
Moore murmured when they had finally found their voice again.
"You probably had to deal with predators just as vicious on your planet."
James sighed. "That really wasn't an attack," he explained. "Just a bit of an overreaction. An actual attack would have been a problem." "That was not an attack?" Queese signed nervously. "Deathworlders are scary." "We are okay if you get to know us better," James laughed and started digging into the strange stew. His laughing caused Queese and Moore to flinch.
You cannot possibly be defending her actions, Moore said, concerned from beside him.
James looked over to her. Well, I'm not saying it was okay what she did, James said, choosing his words carefully now. I'm just saying I don't think she actually wanted to hurt me. It just kind of happened, and I'm not angry about it, so everyone will probably be happier if we just let it go.
She ripped a hole in your arm! How can you be so calm about this?
Moore asked, agitated.
If there weren't so many people there, who knows what she would have done?
Great, so they were doing that again. James looked up into their big eyes, fixating them. This made them seriously uncomfortable. James could feel it.
Like I said, I am not defending what she did. Lashing out like that could have been dangerous if it had been someone less resilient than me, he explained calmly and cold. But there was no malice in what she did. I startled her. She lashed out. If I had not lifted my arm, she probably would not have even hit me. That is all. Nothing more. Nothing less. And she was definitely sorry about it. Moore straightened up, towering over James.
You cannot honestly believe that, they shouted,
causing Queese to cover and scurry back a bit.
She is a predator. They do not care if they hurt somebody.
James was unimpressed by their display. He just looked at them sadly. Is that really what you think? He asked calmly. Dropping their bravado, Moore slumped back down and said, strained but quietly,
Of course I do. They kill and eat other beings. I am not foolish enough to think there are silly things like good or evil in nature. Of course they are not evil. But how could they ever have a conscience if killing is part of their life?
James sighed and took a deep breath, hoisting himself up onto the tabletop, taking a seat opposite of Moore. They looked at that surprisingly. People lifting themselves so easily was unusual. James again chose his words carefully. Is it only part of their life? Predators kill and eat other beings. That is true. They need to in order to survive. But that is not unique to predators, he said. Moore looked appalled.
What are you insinuating?
They asked quietly. I do not know about your world, James explained calmly. But back on Earth, prey animals are usually not too fond of being eaten. If they spot a predator, a lot of them will flee or hide. But just as many will fight. On Earth, a lot of the herbivores are just as vicious as the carnivores in a fight, if not more. They also kill in order to survive, even if they don't eat their kills.
But that is,
Moore began, but James cut them off. Different? I don't think so. But even if it was, then you still couldn't fault Sheeta for her actions. They looked down at him.
And why is that?
They asked, uncertainty starting to taint their voice. James looked back at them and answered with a soft smile. Because her reaction was not that of a predator, but that of prey. Moore looked honestly confused about that.
Explain,
they demanded, but in a meek tone. I already told you, James complied. I startled her, and she lashed out, just like prey would. When she woke up, I saw the fear in her eyes. I suspect that when she woke up, she was expecting to find one of the normal crew members waking her up. I'm assuming this happens more often, and she has grown used to it. But this time, she woke up to find herself defenseless in the gaze of a predator. So she defended herself, like prey does.
You are saying she thought you were hunting her?
Moore summarized what they had understood of his explanation. James nodded. You said that she hails from a death world. On a death world, everyone is prey, he explained further.
But you are not a predator,
Moore exclaimed, not sounding very sure of themselves. Their fur shook around with each of her agitated movements. James didn't even answer. He just held their gaze for a few long moments. Moore sank into themselves. I'll give you some time to digest this, James said and hopped off the table, making his way out of the casino. Come find me in my lab later.
But wait,
Moore stammered out and looked after James.
Where are you going?
James turned around, flashing all of his teeth in a wide smile, and answered, I'll go get some meat. A Job for a Death Worlder, Chapter 2. Written by Lanzen Yars. Read by Daniel Million.